Dog Works Radio is sponsored by Alaska Dog Works. Check out their website at alaskadogworks.com. Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on DogWorksRadio.com or anywhere you find your podcast episodes. And joining me today is the storyteller, host, and producer of our recent series, Iditarod Through the Decades, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. It's, you know, it's very interesting in going through and putting together all of these historical things from Iditarod. It reminded me of a lot of just amazing stories from the various years of Iditarod. And I confess, I've only been following Iditarod since the early 2000s. So I wasn't aware of a lot of the things before, say, 2001 or 2002, when they happened. I've since learned a lot about them, but I wasn't aware of them beforehand. But there are just so many great and amazing stories, some of which were in this series and some of which weren't. And so I'm really happy that we have a chance to, take this episode and kind of go into some of the really amazing stories from over the years.
Like you, Alex, I started following the Iditarod. I guess my following was in the late 90s or so. But like you, so many fans picked up the Iditarod once the internet became online, once people had a little bit better access. You know, when I started following Iditarod, it was all just quick snippets either on cable television or through the news or whatever. It just didn't have the coverage as it does today, but what a way that changed the sport was when, of course, Facebook was a big purveyor in that, but man, the internet really took the sport off, didn't it?
It really did, and, you know, it was one thing to have the internet and to be able to, like, go to Iditarod.com and look at the standings pages and look at, you know, and refresh that before that was online. People were constantly calling into the phone room at Iditarod temporary headquarters in Anchorage, and they would have the phone room staffed like 24 hours a day, and people from all over the world would call in and basically be updated on what was going on. Then that moved to the internet, and then people would, you know, sit up refreshing their browsers every minute or every 20 seconds or something, trying to figure out exactly who was where. And, you know, even since then, in the last 10 years or so, we've had the advent of the GPS trackers, which makes it a whole different race to follow, because you can literally see who's going, how fast they're going, what their run rest cycles are. So all of these things have enabled fans to get much more involved with what's happening during the race. And that's very, very exciting. Prior to that, there was, you know, you would read news articles that would sometimes be a day or two or a week or two delayed, and it just wasn't nearly as immediate.
Right. And, you know, one thing that Facebook and social media really kicked off, and I don't know if this is one of your stories or not, but it was the ability for the teams on the trail to tell stories as they were working their way down the trail, whether they were, you know, talking to their handler crew or their, you know, the peoples at the checkpoints or whatever, all of a sudden we could receive updates on our favorite teams through their Facebook pages and through their social media channels. And I know several mushers are really good at it. Ones in particular I'm thinking of are Ali Zirkel and Alan Moore's kennel, Wade Mars and his girlfriend and soon-to-be wife's kennel. The Reddingtons do a great job. Hugh Neff does a great job when they're updating on the internet. But man, when you can receive real-time updates, that really adds an interesting fan's perspective, doesn't it?
It really does. And one of the rookies this year that I know a lot of people are very excited about is Blair Braverman. And she and her husband and kennel partner are just magnificent at that. They may be the best mushers at social media that we have seen to date, and they have a very devoted fan base, and that is mostly people that they've attracted and who are following them as a result of their social media presence.
Right. So let's jump into this. I do not know what your favorite stories are, so I'm going to be pleasantly surprised to hear some of these, especially the ones that you did not cover in the episodes. Let's start off with the first one. What do you have for us?
So I think that one of my favorite stories is the Rick Mackey photo finish victory in 1978. And that is something that it's the only photo finish. It's the closest race ever. It was, it was neck and neck coming down Front Street. And what I love about this story is two things. First of all, the story itself, that after over 1,000 miles, that there was a race that was so close that it was, that it was basically a photo finish. And Dick Mackey was coming down Front Street. He was about to collapse. He was very slightly in the lead over Rick Swenson. And then Mackey's dogs crossed the finish line. Mackey's lead dog crossed the finish line first. He collapsed and fell into the crowd. And then Rick Swenson's dogs crossed, and Rick Swenson actually made it across the finish line before Mackey made it across. And there was some confusion about who had actually won. And the race judges huddled, and they decided that, as in horse racing, what counts is when the nose of the animal, of the first animal, crosses the finish line, not when the driver, when the human being attached to the animals, crosses. So that seemed to be a very Alaskan and commonsensical way of looking at this, and it was decided relatively quickly right there when they were all on Front Street, and I think that might be one of my favorite moments of all out of any Iditarod.
You know, you said it best when you said 1,000 miles from the start to the finish, and they ended up finishing in just a few seconds apart. I think that really tells the tale of just how competitive this type of race is, even way back in the early 70s when, you know, it wasn't the race it is today where, you know, it's in eight days and, you know, a few hours. Back then, it was a heck of a lot longer race, and if you can finish in that short amount of time with two teams together, that's a competitive streak amongst two men, isn't it?
It really is, and, you know, there are a lot of people who felt that and still feel that Swenson should have won. It's one of those things where it's a moment in Iditarod lore, and people look at the pictures from that finish and it immediately takes them back. And there's video that you can find online on YouTube of the two teams coming in, and it is amazing. I mean, you talk about athletes wanting to leave everything on the field, and it is clear watching Dick Mackey that he is giving everything in his being to get his team across the finish line first. And that's why almost immediately when his dogs have crossed the line, he just collapses. He has pretty much nothing left at that point. And it's a really remarkable sports moment.
It is, for sure. So what's the next one, Alex?
So continuing with the Mackey theme, there's actually a couple of things with Lance Mackey, but the first one is that Lance, when he won his first Iditarod, it was his sixth race, and he drew bib number 13. When his dad, Dick Mackey, won, it also was his sixth race, and he also drew bib number 13. And then when Lance's brother, Rick, had won a few years before that, it was his sixth race, and he drew bib number 13. So there was something magical about that that coincidence that really seemed to make it appear that Lance Mackey was destined to win his first Iditarod. And I've always loved that. And the second thing, of course, is Lance Mackey sneaking out of the checkpoint to get ahead of Jeff King and winning, I believe it was his third Iditarod. When King's team was performing better and was going faster, and they were neck and neck, and Lance knew that the only way that he was going to win was if he could watch for Jeff to close his eyes and fall asleep and sneak out ahead and be able to gain a little bit of distance and a little bit of time.
You know, you talked about that win for Lance when he was wearing bib number 13, and I just remember that iconic picture of him running up Front Street, and he's in his red snowsuit and parka, and he's pointing at the bib like, check this out. And you know, that just reminds me of all those very cool iconic sports photos that we're familiar with, whether it be, you know, the Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, or I think it was Dwight Clark in the Super Bowl catching that one-headed catch from Joe Montana. You know, just some of those photos that we remember from sports. I think that one really stands out, and it really kind of captures the moment of, sports and sort of that quest for victory and all that goes with it.
Yeah. And I think looking at the – I made a quick list before we went on air of some of the stories that I wanted to talk about, and I think that the rest of these are going to be much less well-known. So I'll just sort of jump into a few of them.
Sure.
Cindy Abbott, who is suffering from a degenerative eye disease and who had previously climbed Mount Everest, when she was running her first Iditarod, she had an incident where she crashed into a tree very early on in the race, I think 30 or 40 miles into the race. She then went another 300 miles before she recognized that she was in too much pain and couldn't bend over and couldn't complete her dog chores. So she had to scratch about 300 or 400 miles into the race. She was airlifted back to Anchorage, and the doctors examined her, and it turned out that she had broken her pelvis when she collided with the tree very early in the race. So she broke her pelvis, and yet she still managed to go another 300 miles, doing all of the things involved with running a dog team and feeding and taking care of the dogs and bootying the dogs and getting very little rest while she must have been in unbelievable pain. And I look to examples like that every time I feel like something is going wrong for me and I'm uncertain or I'm in pain, because I think, oh, well, you know, Cindy Abbott went hundreds of miles with a broken pelvis, so I shouldn't complain about whatever it is that I want to complain about.
You know, that's a great story, Alex. And, you know, when I think about that, I think of two things. The first one is just how tough this sport is. And you think about other sports like baseball, and they call a game in the middle of the third inning because there's a little bit of a sprinkle, and they run out and throw tarps on the field and, you know, have a rain delay. But then what's, I think, even more cool with this story is, I know we talked about this on our show previously, but last year when you had your first experience on a sled and you fell off and ended up breaking your shoulder, dislocating and breaking a bone in your shoulder, and as you worked your way down the trail trying to get back to the kennel, who did you run into? Cindy Abbott. Tell us a little bit about that, Alex.
Right. I was I had taken a wrong turn. I was on your snow machine at this point, and I had taken a wrong turn and trying to get back to the kennel, and was sort of in the trail and wasn't sure what to do. So I was just kind of sitting there, and Cindy was running a dog team with somebody else and came up, and, you know, I told her that I was hurt. She helped me move the snow machine off. And you know, when she came up, the first thing she said, she recognized me and she said, "Alex, what are you doing here?" And I told her the story, and then as she was driving off, I heard her say to the other person that she was with, she said, "Yeah, he fell, he got injured, that's mushing."
Very good. And it took you a while to recover, but I think you're back at it and ready to jump back into the game. Hopefully you jump back on a sled here in a couple of weeks, and I look forward to being with you to do that. What is the next one, Alex?
So the next one is Larry Daugherty, who is an oncologist. He's a local in Anchorage. He's been on Mushing Radio a couple of times. Really, really great and inspirational guy, who ran Jason Campo's team when Jason was injured in the Yukon Quest and had, I think, 2 weeks' notice that he was going to run the Iditarod with Jason's dogs to you know, keep them up and keep them in training. And the thing about him that I've always really admired is that he carries with him prayer flags, like Buddhist prayer flags that you see on mountains, in honor of his patients who did not survive. And I think that we've talked over the years about a number of people who have, you know, for example, taken the ashes of sled dogs up the trail and scattered them there, and people who run the Iditarod to raise awareness for, you know, sobriety or other causes. And I think that that's the sort of thing that has always inspired me about Iditarod and the people who run Iditarod, especially the middle of the packers or the back of the packers, because that's something that is deeply meaningful to them, and unfortunately is not really talked about very much when the race is covered. So Larry is sort of the example of all of those people who are running Iditarod who have like some sort of special message, either a personal message or a more public-facing message that they're bringing with them along the trail.
And that sort of ties back into the Cindy Abbott story with Mount Everest. I know that Larry Daugherty, I don't know if he is the director of the nonprofit or he just sits on the board, but he works with a company or a nonprofit called Radiating Hope, and they go to Everest every year and raise awareness and money for this organization in climbing Mount Everest, and this is where that tie-in with the flags comes in that you had talked about, and I think that's a really cool example of both types of activities or sports with Mount Everest, which is obviously not easy at all, but that in parallel with Iditarod, two very extreme endurance events, and both of them sort of working hand in hand to reach that common goal.
Absolutely, we think of sled dogs as being like very highly trained athletes, and they are. But you know, there's this feeling that sled dogs have to come from a specific line, and if you can get, you know, a line of Susan Butcher dogs or a line of you know, Dallas Seavey dogs, that's the best thing to do. But a while ago, in 2010 and 2012, Colleen Robertia ran Iditarod with a team of rescue dogs. So she got these dogs who were at various kennels and shelters who would have been euthanized if they had not been adopted, and she rescued these dogs. She worked with them to train them as sled dogs, and she ran Iditarod twice, and in 2012 even finished in 21st place, which, you know, although there's a huge difference between finishing in 21st place and being someone who can, you know, contend and win Iditarod. Finishing 21st is very, very respectable. It's like middle of the pack, almost at the head of the pack. So that's kind of amazing, and the fact that she did it with rescue dogs has always inspired me. She and her husband, I believe, continue to run a kennel. They don't race anymore. I read an article that her husband and kennel partner wrote a couple years back where he said that he said something to the effect of, back when we used to not want to hang on to any of our money, we would race competitively. but still, having someone who could train and run a group of rescue dogs at a very high level is itself inspirational to me.
I agree with you 100%. You know, I have a lot of dogs in our kennel that we have gotten from other dog mushers who didn't make their A teams and, you know, weren't the best sled dogs for them. And we ended up taking them under our wing and inviting them to our kennel, and they've done very well. But yeah, working with the rescue dogs, or what some people call the cast off dogs, is a special experience. And I really enjoy working. I enjoy working with all of them, but those older guys that I have in my team just have that special place in my heart, and that bond that we've shared, just because they've given it their all, and, you know, they're just so happy to run no matter where it's at.
Absolutely. I also wanted to mention just briefly, we've had Rachel Scuderis, who is legally blind, but has run Iditarod several times, usually having another musher to run with her and sort of act as her eyes on the trail. And it's really amazing to me that someone could overcome that kind of disability and be able to still run Iditarod. And then kind of on the other end of that, someone recovering from something very serious was Didi Genro, who ran the Iditarod just a few weeks after she had finished chemotherapy, when she was suffering, I believe, from breast cancer. And those two things are also very inspirational. You know, a lot of people feel like, oh, I'm not able to do this. This requires too much, and yet here are people who were going through things or had conditions that made them inherently much less able to function at the level that most normal people can function at, and yet they were able to find a way to compete in Iditarod, and that is amazing to me as well.
Definitely for me as well. Just that overcoming adversity, overcoming those challenges, it's so difficult to make it to the starting line, then of course to work your way down that 1,000 miles and end up finishing. You hear the stories all the time of the struggles, you know, the everyday life struggles in dog mushing, and it's true in any sport. But you talked about Dee Dee Genro and her comeback after chemo, and I know we've talked about this on a previous episode, is right after the big fire up here, the Sockeye fire, she pretty much lost everything, her house and, you know, everything except for a few mementos and her dogs, and she ended up doing the race the same year. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Core. I got to say it, hardcore for sure. Alex, can I share one of my favorite stories before we go?
Oh, please do.
You know, you had told this story in the episode, but this is one that has always really touched me, probably more than any other. It's the story of Martin Bucer and him going down the trail and becoming an American citizen under the arch in Nome. I thought that was such a cool way to celebrate his new citizenship, and it was right after 9/11. 9/11 happened in September, and this was in March. I guess it would be the following year. So was that 6 months or so that he took that step? And I think that's such a cool thing for Martin to do. Do you want to add anything to that?
No, I totally agree with that. It's one of my favorite Iditarod moments as well. Do we have time for a couple of more?
Yeah, a couple more.
So one of my favorite moments also is way at the back of the pack in 2010. There was a musher named Scott White, and he was at safety, and he had stopped for a little bit in safety, not too long, and then when he tried to start up again, his dogs just didn't want to go, and he tried multiple times to let them rest and then put them back in harness, and finally he believed that he was going to have to scratch, but you can't officially scratch, or at the time you couldn't officially scratch until you speak to the race marshal, and he wasn't able to get hold of the race marshal. So he wound up just sitting there in safety, and eventually, safety's only 22 miles from Nome, and eventually someone came out from Nome, and they said, you know, you could probably walk your dogs into Nome. It's not that far. And then they said, and in fact, if you start walking and your dogs are in harness, they'll probably follow you because they don't want to be, you know, they've been with you for 1,000 miles. They don't want to be left alone. And so he put his dogs back in harness. He started walking and didn't look back. And after a while, his dogs followed him, and he jumped on the sled and was able to finish his race rather than scratching. And at the Brawled Arch, he joked about that he had been told, he had mistakenly believed that there was a 12-hour mandatory rest in safety because he was literally, I believe, at that checkpoint for nearly 12 hours. And yet, you know, he just was able to figure out a way to make his dogs go, something very unusual, very unconventional, but it worked. So I've always loved stories like that.
Right. Yeah, I remember that one. I remember covering that one on the show. I think that was one of the first years where we were doing our daily coverage of Iditarod, and I think we were just finishing up with the previous broadcast when that happened, or getting ready to air, and I remember just how excited I was to talk about that in the next episode, because it was such a cool finish for Scott. And I thought, what a way to, you know, that's dog mushing. If your dogs don't want to go, you got to figure out a way to get them to go, because you cannot push them down the trail. I've been to that scenario so many times where I'm just pulling my hair out, figuring out why these guys don't want to go, whether they're, you know, too hot, too tired, want to rest more, want to have another snack, whatever. You know, dogs can't talk, and they tell you pretty much up front, hey, we're not doing this if we don't want to. And you got to figure out a way to motivate them. That's what makes dog mushers dog mushers, and I thought that was such a cool way to experience that.
Yeah, and then the final thing, and this is much more general, but I think that for everyone who runs Iditarod, whether they're someone who's in contention, whether they're a middle of the packer, whether they're a back of the packer, whether they're someone who's going to scratch early in the race or scratch late in the race, everyone who runs, and I think a lot of the fans pick up on this maybe without realizing it, is really embodying the spirit of Joe Reddington Sr. And when Joe Reddington Sr. Envisioned this race, he didn't know if it was even possible to do it. And nearly every year there have been things that make what they're trying to do in getting to Nome seem impossible or seem very, very difficult. And yet everyone has this attitude that they don't know exactly how they're going to be able to do it, but they start and they move forward and they figure that they will figure it out if they put their mind to it. It reminds me of one of my favorite books when I was growing up was The Phantom Toll Booth. And in The Phantom Toll Booth, there are these two kingdoms that this little kid is trying to reunite. And all throughout the book, people keep saying to him, "Oh, there's something very important that I have to tell you, but I need to wait until you're finished before I tell you." And then when he finishes, the thing that everyone wanted to tell him is, "What you're trying to do is impossible, but I don't want to tell you until you've actually done it." And I think there's a lot of that spirit in everyone who runs Iditarod, that you're trying to do things that are impossible, but go ahead and try to do them. And then when you've done them, I'll tell you that it really was impossible what you were trying to do.
I love that. I had not heard that that analogy or that story before, and that might be something I need to pick up and read. I really appreciate you talking about that. Alex, it has been a pleasure hearing your stories and some of your favorite moments in your coverage of coming up with these for our last series, and I do want to thank you for that. And next episode, we're going to talk about the future. Where does the future hold for Iditarod? And we're also going to do a little bit of behind the scenes. I'm going to ask Alex some questions about sort of the making of Iditarod through the decades. So it's been my pleasure, Alex. We'll talk again soon, okay?
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.
From Dog Works Radio, this is Mushing Radio. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we invite you to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find a link on the episode notes. You can tap or swipe on the episode cover art, and you'll see some offers from our sponsors. You can support our show by supporting them. If you like what you have heard, we would love it if you could give us a 5-star rating and tell your friends how to subscribe too. Your hosts are Alex Stein and Robert Forto. Our producer is Robert Forto, created for Dog Works Radio. Did you know that Alaska Dog Works trains service dogs for those in need throughout North America? Each and every service dog that is trained through the Lead Dog Service Dog Program and Michelle Forto and her team has an individual training plan. We train for autistic, mobility, psychiatric, and PTSD for our soldiers for service work. If you know of someone that may need a service dog, please take a moment and check out Alaska Dog Works on social media and at alaskadogworks.com.